Everybody and welcome. It's 11 p.m. Wednesday, September 4th, 2019, and thanks for joining us for the 75th episode of the Rock and Roll Shrink Radio Show here on Blog Talk Radio. Special thanks to our host, NDB Media. I'm Casey Shapiro, and with me tonight is Dr. Stephen Mathis, aka the Rock and Roll Shrink. We will be taking calls from our listeners all evening during the show at 914-338-0314. You can also follow along in our live chat room on blogtalkradio.com as the show is happening. Before we begin, a couple quick disclaimers. This show does not constitute a doctor-client relationship, nor legal or medical representation of any kind. Also, the views expressed on this show are those of Dr. Mathis and Ms. Shapiro and are not an official stance on behalf of the psychological community or its peer vetting or regulatory bodies. And now, a topic-relevant bit of music played by Dr. Mathis himself. Take it away, Doc. As always, thank you for that, and if you would, please let us know the name of the song and the artist, and its relevance to tonight's topic.
Well, I think everybody within the sound of my voice probably knows that song. If they don't, they've probably been living under a rock. So that was the infamous Anarchy in the UK by the Sex Pistols off their one and only record, Never Mind the Bollocks. And the reason that I... Well, come on. I mean, let's get complete here. And if the reason, if you're wondering why I did that song, it's kind of connected to my previous selection, since as we're going to be talking about conduct and oppositional problems often accompany ADHD, particularly in teenagers and young adults, I thought that would be kind of a very appropriate choice to make, since most teenagers are pretty... Anarchy-esque anyway. I thought this was just kind of covering like a lot of bases, and I certainly am a closet iconoclast, so that's sort of a wussy version of anarchist. I don't think I quite make the grade, but you know, I keep trying, right?
Fair enough. Fair enough. Okay, you get your anarchist cookie. Okay, so as Dr. Mathis mentions, tonight's episode is entitled, Is ADHD a Misnomer? Part 2, which we will discuss in a moment. Before we begin our topic discussion, let's first go to the Rock and Roll Shrink Recalls, a moment of rock music trivia stories as recounted by Dr. Mathis, if you would, sir.
So tonight, what I thought I would do is talk about a topic that most people probably they're aware of, but they don't know they're aware of it. So, of course, what I'm talking about is this thing called a baritone guitar. So for folks who don't know what that is, excuse me, it is basically a regular six-string guitar that has been strung up and wired to be played in B instead of E. So in other words, it's five half steps below concert pitch. So folks go, oh, I don't know if I've ever heard of that. Yeah, you have. You've heard it a whole lot more than you know you've heard it. And it has a very long history. Most people who are aware of baritone guitars usually associate them with Korn or Seven Dust or Staind or some of the, or even Metallica during the St. Anger period, where you definitely hear seven-string baritone guitars and six-string baritone guitars. But the history of baritones go way before the 2000s. So they actually start with people, believe it or not, Glenn Campbell and Duane Eddy and even Ennio Morricone orchestra. One of the guys there had a six-string bass, which is not really a baritone, and a baritone. And he played both of those during all of the spaghetti western soundtracks. That's what that weird-sounding hollow guitar is. It's not really a guitar. It's a Fender six-string bass and occasionally a baritone. So a lot of people say, well, really isn't a six-string bass just baritone? No. They are not the same thing. And I'm talking about one of the old Fender six basses, not one of the newer versions where it's six strings and you have an extra B and a high B. This is the old Fender six strings were tuned exactly like a guitar. And they were on like a Jazzmaster Jaguar body. And they had skinny strings like a guitar, but they're a little bit fatter. And they had a whammy bar on them. So you don't think that was strange. Well, the baritones, yeah. Well, I love those things. Jack Bruce played one on the first Cream record. He had a six-string, a Fender six-string bass, and after the first record, he traded it in for a Cloud, an SG Cloud bass by Gibson, four-string, which he played through the rest of Cream's career. But at any rate, the baritones are a different animal entirely. They're sort of a cross between a six-string bass and electric guitar, because whereas the six-string basses of the 60s Fender era were tuned exactly like a guitar except an octave down, the baritones are five half steps below concert pitch, and they're tuned just like a guitar. So when you play them, they have a thick kind of sound. Three Days Grace uses them a lot, so does Breaking Benjamin. So that's what produces that kind of thick, muddy, kind of overdriven-y, kind of grungy type sound, and you go, oh, they're just, you know, turning all the bass on the amp, and no, they're actually using baritones. That's how they get that tone. So the baritones actually were used even prior to that in popular music as early as the B-52's Rock Lobster and The Cure's Disintegration.
Oh.
Yeah, so both of those are done with baritones, right? So what happens is, initially, what a lot of guys and gals tried to do is they said, well, let's take a regular guitar and turn the piss out of the, you know, excuse my rudeness, out of the strings down, you know. But what happens is most guitar players use, you know, standard gauge strings. So they usually, you know, unless you're Billy Gibbons of ZZ Top and usually 007s, I guess he was a James Bond freak, you know. Okay. Actually, there's a story behind that. God, I need a keeper. He was playing 12s on his first, so gauges of strings, for folks who don't know, is gauged, no pun intended, by the millimeter diameter of the first string. And so the first string on most guys and gals guitars that play popular music are either 10s, if they're heavy strings or tens, most of the folks are using nines or eights, and occasionally, in Billy Gibbons' case, a seven. He used to use 12s because somebody told him that all the old blues guys, the way they got their tone was they used these uber heavy strings, and they just, you know, their fingers hurt all the time. And so when he was playing with B.B. King early in the day, he and B.B. were kibitzing backstage, and B.B. was playing Billy's guitar, and he goes, "Man, you're using why are you using these really heavy strings?" And Billy goes, "Well, I thought all you guys," he goes, "dude, why are you making this hard?" And he hands him one of the Lucille's, which has like nines on it. And he's like, "Oh my God." And he goes, "Yeah, dude, we don't want to work that hard." So Billy eventually switched to nines. And then eventually, he's been playing sevens forever. And they actually didn't make sevens. Ernie Ball made him a special set. And they have now gone on the market. And they're the Billy Gibbons, you know, brand set. They've been out for about 10 years now. But yeah. But let me get away from my digression and go back to the baritones. So what a guys would do, and when you start turning the strings lower to make them five steps below concert pitch, the strings get floppy because the neck is made for the tension to be concert pitch.
If they had to do something funny to the strings.
Yeah, and it just flopped the strings, and it sounded like ass. So what happens is, enter the baritone guitars, which are longer scale necks, so they can accommodate the longer strings. They can be lowered pitched and lowered tension without flopping. And so most of the scale lengths on a baritone are something like 26 and a half to 30. And even 26 and a half on the low end is like an inch longer than a Fender Strat, which is one of the longer neck guitars. You know, so it's like, whoa. And you pick up a baritone, and I have one. If you pick up a baritone, they are noticeably that you feel like you're like, you know, stretching to the moon to get to the headstock. I mean, it's a long throw. But they don't sound like anything else. They have this signature kind of growl to them. You know, folks like Bolt Thrower and Carcass have been using them a long time. They started out detuning their guitars, and they said, okay, well, let's just put real heavy gauge strings on them and dial tune them because that'll keep the tension somewhat tighter. So some of the guys still do that. Morbid Angel had a seven string that they were using, that was in like the early 90s before they were really popular. And that extra string gives them the kind of a funk drone that they would do. But they had to use all these really heavy strings. So if you get a baritone, you don't have to use really heavy strings because you've got the extra length of tensions just right on it. So that's why you see people, I mean, there's a lot of people who now make baritone guitars. And a lot of that is the result of these folks going, hey, we're tired of this floppy crap and we want some cool, dirty, you know, grungy, you know, guttural kind of tones, but we don't want strings flopping everywhere. So, you know, people like Rob Flynn got this thing going, and he eventually got Epiphone to make him what he called the Love Death Baritone Flying V. So it's a flying V guitar that's a baritone. And, you know, so a lot of foreign manufacturers have also come to the game. So Solar Guitars, which is a Norwegian company, certainly a Scandinavian country, at the behest of Mars Larsen, at the Gates guitar player, who's they're very heavy, thick band, got them to make them. So, you know, enter the 2000s, where people like Korn are using them, they started out using them, and they got Ibanez to make them a seven-string guitar that had all that thick baritone-y kind of thing. The Seven Dust guitar player guy, Clint Lowry, and Chevelle's guitar player, Pete Loeffler, all have baritones. And as I mentioned, Metallica's James Hetfield, for one album, the St. Anger album, he used a baritone on that. All right. Some of them will drop it down to C, drop C, what's called a drop C tune. Some of them will do it to B. Some will do it to A flat. But all of these baritones are set up to be detuned extensively so that you're not flopping the strings around, right? Yeah. And the Fuel guitar, he jokingly referred to it as the Grinch. and it was a baritone version of ESP Guitar's Viper. So all of these guys, Schecter makes them now. There's a lot of these guys that make a lot of these manufacturers. And, you know, if you have a baritone made by one of the major companies back in the day, you paid serious money for them. You had to be a professional musician or have a shoot ton of disposable income. Now, a lot of the lower-end guitar, and I'm not slamming these guys, but the folks that make cheaper guitars, lower-end, you know, they're not uber high-end professional or whatever's, so that making them so that a lot of folks can, you know, who aren't rich and famous can play baritones and seven string baritones and, you know, just sound like their favorite stars because they're playing that stuff. The Deftones guy uses one. He's has an ESP, I think. Fear Factory's guy plays one. And I think his is made by Ormsby Guitars. They're an Australian manufacturer. Those things will cost you an arm and a leg. So again, you can go uber pricey, play, you know, $5,000, $6,000, $8,000, $10,000 for one, or you can get one that's more reasonably priced. It's, you know, not as heady and not as artsy fartsy and not as handmade beautiful, but you can still have a baritone and play it. You can sound like Animals as Leaders or, you know, any of these guys, or Korn or any of these guys, because that's the kind of stuff they use. So Jackson and Ibanez guitars are making a shoot ton of these guitars. And actually, Ibanez has now, well, it's actually, they started like in 2007, 2008, making an 8-string guitar. So that just
Whoa.
Adds another, yeah, just adds another thick drone kind of dilly to it. Steve Vai plays a 7-string, but his is not a baritone. He has an Ibanez, the Gem, but it's not a baritone. It's just a 7-string with extra scale, so he can do all those little, you know, acrobatics that he does so effortlessly that the rest of us kind of just shake our heads and go, huh?
I was gonna say,
so yeah, there's
change chord figurings is for all kinds of stuff.
Yes, but all this really started back in the Duane Eddy, Glenn Campbell, Ennio Morricone days, and, you know, starts back in popular music, you know, to the not country, not rockabilly stuff, to people, you know, like the B-52's Rock Lobster and the Cure's Disintegration album. So this stuff goes, and that's like, I don't know, 87, 89. I mean, that stuff goes way back in terms of, you know, guitar history, for in terms of the baritone stuff. So people think there's something new, and they're really not. They're just, a lot of people don't know about them, and they listen to them, and they don't even know they're hearing them. I mean, for a long time, when I was listening to 3 Days Grace, which is one of my more favorite newer kind of bands, and I was listening to stuff and going, God, that, you know, that's a, they can't, what the hell are they doing? And they flopping the string. And then I realized when I got a baritone and started playing, I'm like, oh my God, they're playing baritones. And I felt like an idiot. I'm like, okay, dumbass. Where's your ear? You supposedly had, Mr. Musician Boy. You know? But, you know, you can do so many things with amps these days in terms of, you know, modding them and getting, you know, dirtier sounding tubes and tone. You just kind of think, oh, I guess they're just cranking up. They're turning down the treble and cranking up. You know, kind of like back in the day when Clapton had the woman tone that he got out of his SG, the Fool, when he was playing with the Cream, right? You know, so you just assume, I just assumed, oh, I guess they're doing some cool, you know, tuning. But nope, they got baritones. So that's the story of the baritone guitar. You've probably heard it many times and don't even know you've heard it.
That is fascinating to me. Now, when I was very young in elementary school, I first learned to play the ukulele because I had a Hawaiian aunt. And I learned that right before the guitar. And one of my schoolmates in the elementary school actually owned a baritone ukulele. And this had to be about circa 75. And I'd never seen or heard of such a thing before. I was fascinated, and I'd never seen one since. And this has me all curious, you know, like chicken and egg, which one kind of came out first, you know? Because it's the same
well,
era.
Well, yeah, because the
about.
Baritone back with Glenn Campbell, Duane Eddy era, all those probably came up about the same time. Somebody probably saw one and went, "Hey, we need to do one of those."
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
All right, so let's get some applause in there for that fun story.
Okay, well,
definitely.
Thank you for the clap.
oh. least it wasn't the class.
Okay.
Oh, we'll be punning all night. Okay. We will take calls from our listeners and questions and puns in the online chat room throughout the evening until around midnight. So please feel free to give us a call. Again, the number is 914-338-0314. Okay, so tonight's show, very high possibility we might run over the hour, just so you guys know, and we're going to go ahead and let it do that. So that we can get this out of the way. We've had to postpone the show a couple of times, something on Dr. Mathis's Zen and then something on mine. And so we want to go ahead and get this going so you guys can get caught up, because we did part one of this show almost a month ago, and we want to get this out to you. Tonight's show is ADHD, a misnomer, part two. So the pathology currently known as attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD, has undergone myriad redefinitions and renamings since its codification around the 1950s in the DSM-1. But it may be possible that psychology still has work to do in tweaking the diagnosis and complete understanding of this condition. There are traits known by clinicians and psychologists to be valid aspects of the disorder that are largely unknown outside professional circles, and the disorder's name reflects this incomplete understanding. We want to talk about the history of the professional understanding of the disorder, primarily, which we did that last week, how it is seen today, and some known gaps in the understanding which need addressing and inclusion for the benefit of those with the pathology. So on our previous show, we spent the hour discussing the history of ADHD, the naming, diagnosis, and treatments, and it was important for you guys to get that history and understanding so that you could see how we got where we are with the names we've got and the diagnoses we've got now. You know, there was a whole pattern to it. And also, I know that you guys have sat through other lectures we've given where diagnoses have changed or been moved around. And so this is something of a fluid process. And just because it's codified in one version doesn't necessarily mean that's the last answer. And that has a little bit to do with tonight. So with that in mind, tonight we will discuss first symptoms and currently used diagnoses. Next, relevant, often overlooked or downplayed traits, executive dysfunction, RSD, which is rejection sensitive dysphoria, poor impulse control, and the dopamine connection. And last, is the name a misnomer or unfairly shaming? What should it be called instead? And before we get started, I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, and see if there's anything that you care to say before we get going.
I'm good, thanks.
All righty. So, symptoms and currently used diagnoses. Let's see. Okay. The currently used official model of ADHD includes at least these three areas of concern. And actually, before I read them off, I have a note here I wanted to ask you. Are these three areas of concern true of everyone that's diagnosed with ADHD? That's to you, Dr.
Okay. What three areas?
What three are they?
About?
Okay. Inattention or focus problems, hyperactivity, and is this always physical or could mental hyperactivity count? And impulse control problems.
Oh, okay. Right. All ADHD people have some version of inattention. For some folks, it's a lot worse than others. For some folks, it is clearly their predominant factor, and they have very little hyperactivity. They may have a little bit, but not a whole lot. And that ergo the predominantly, you know, which used to be called predominantly inattentive type, that's now called inattentive presentation. Then you have the people that are predominantly hyperactive, and then you have the folks that are some mix of both. And for the folks who have predominantly inattentive features, the hyperactivity is generally what I call internal. Their brain's jumping from one thing to the next thing to the next thing. They may or may not be fidgeting, or if they do, they may fidget covertly so that you don't really notice it, or they may not fidget very much, and so, you know, that's not a big deal. Impulse control problems are prevalent in the vast majority of ADHD people. Now, that doesn't mean they're going to go blow up, you know, the White House if they disagree with something that the president says, or they're going to punch you in the face if you, you know, do something that they don't like. but they will sometimes act in an impulsive manner that often, that you know, will sometimes come back to bite them in their posteriors in one form or another. And some of the impulse control issues are, you know, anger-based, aggressive, and some of them are just, oh, it feels like a good thing to do at the time, but it was the first thing that came to my head, and I just did it.
Yeah.
That has no negative. You know, yeah, that has no, you know, hostile intention whatsoever.
Got it. Okay. So this gets into other common traits frequently downplayed or overlooked due to the name of the disorder. And I had repeated impulse control in this list because it is not part of the official name of the diagnosis. So
yeah, neither is executive dysfunction, which is what it really is.
Exactly. Although, and we'll talk about that in a minute. And it's something of a slight misnomer to say that that's really what it is, but it's definitely a huge, huge part of it that isn't talked about. And that's what we're doing tonight. We are gesturing very vehemently at some of these things that are considered to be standard parts of it, but they're not treated like that. They're not treated like the hyperactivity and so forth. And
which
we want to make sure. Go ahead.
Right. And I was going to say, which is probably why people don't really understand it. And they also don't understand hyperactivity as being shaking your foot or clicking a pencil or playing with a rubber band or twisting your hair. They see it as, you know, Beavis on a sugar rush walking around going, I am Cornelio, you know, and, and causing all this major disruption. And you do have people who are like that. But, you know, that's sort of the stereotypic poster child. You got to be kidding me. You don't see that as often as you do people who fidget semi-quietly, or they fidget in a way that doesn't draw a shoot ton of attention to themselves. They're not, you know, destroying property and that kind of stuff.
Yes. And I think that point is imperative that our listeners make, because I got a lot of commentary about this from various people who were helping to contribute, experiences and anecdotes to this. One of the things that was said is, I'm not hyperactive. And we have discussed before on this show multiple times that hyperactivity is part of it for everyone. But what I think a lot of people don't understand is that we're not talking about Beavis. You know, hyperactivity presents in different people in different ways, and sometimes they develop coping mechanisms to cover it up, and they don't even realize that's what's going on. But if you were to put a camera on them and kind of distract them from the camera and let them just be themselves, they would probably come to find out that they too are hyperactive and they just don't realize how it's presenting.
Right. I think I told you the story where I was, I was testing this young gal, and she is clearly the most hyperactive female I've ever tested, ever. I mean, literally of any age. And she got to the point where getting to something and she starts humming, and kind of semi-whistling. And I'm giggling to myself because I realize she has no clue she's doing it.
Oh,
so,
okay.
It was hilarious. It was so cute. And so at the end of the testing session, I said, wow, I bet you're getting a lot of trouble at school for that. She goes, what? I went, oh,
no.
My God. It was so cute. And I said, you didn't realize you were humming and whistling, huh? And she looked at her eyes got really big. She's like, oh, my God, was I really?
Oh, no.
I was like, yeah, I'm afraid so.
Yeah, and that's
oh
what
God,
I tried
I'm
to
so
explain
sorry.
To some people. Yeah, they might be completely and utterly unaware of it, whereas we're looking across the room and go, if you click that pen one more time, we're going to reenact the musical from Chicago.
Yeah, really. It was so funny because she was clearly unaware of it. She was clearly embarrassed. She clearly did not do it intentionally. And she's like, oh, my God. And I said, well, think of it this way. It's your body's psychomotor muscle groups trying to generate extra dopamine because your brain's going, we're dying in here. More dopamine, you know, more cowbell, more dopamine.
Yes.
And, right?
Exactly.
And that's not moving enough.
You know, you talked about it, and we're about to get into a detail. Dopamine irregularities wasn't mentioned too much by the people giving me anecdotes, but you've mentioned it, and some of the white papers I saw mentioned it. Dopamine irregularities is a huge part of this that is not talked about. Yeah.
Oh, God. That's what's responsible for the executive dysfunction.
Yes.
Because without that, your brain's not differentiating correctly from the get-go. And then it can't produce enough dopamine to keep your focus and attention going. So the muscles are going, okay, we're dying. The brain's going, we're dying here. And it gets the muscles to move. And anytime your muscles move, whether it's walking, talking, chewing gum, flipping your fingers, whatever, you're creating dopamine. And so it's the body's unconscious way of trying to get you to produce more dopamine. And if you're sitting down, your body's like, okay, we're really dying over here. Now we got to really get you moving. And so that's really what it is. It's not done to tick people off. It's not done to be annoying. It's done in large part unconsciously. Yeah.
So now let's do an overview of how ADHD is currently diagnosed in the DSM-5. The complete list of criteria and changes is dauntingly long and would likely monopolize the entirety of our show. So what I've done is I've saved a few highlights that are likely of special interest to adults with ADHD, who is going to be predominantly our listeners here, who may have a vested interest in show topic relevant reinterpretation in the diagnostic criteria. So in other words, there's some stuff in here that's true, but I'm not really sensing that you guys would be as interested in that as the things that I selected for you. So a lot of these are Dr. Mathis's direct notes about stuff that is used to diagnose us. And I want you guys to be able to hear this, what people are looking for, not so you can like live into it or pretend to be doing it, but I want you to understand what the clinician's going to be looking for. So first part is changes from the DSM-4 to the DSM-5 for ADHD. And there were three that I think sound like they'd be really something that means a lot to you guys to hear. So one of the changes is a comorbid diagnosis with autism spectrum disorder is now allowed. That wasn't a thing before 5. The next one is adults only need to meet 5 symptoms out of the list that they have, and there's 8 items in there, rather than 6 required for minors in either of the 2 major domains to be diagnosed with ADHD. And then the last one is the disorder was moved from the disruptive behavior disorders category to the neurodevelopmental disorders category, which goes along with what we just got done saying, that this is a dopamine malfunction. And so it was taken out of disruptive behaviors because that's not what it's about. It's a biochemical error. And so they've changed the category to reflect understanding that. And that's kind of what we're all about tonight, is pointing at some more things that need to be tidied up. You know, if they do another addendum to DSM-5 or when 6 comes out, and hopefully in the field before that. Okay, so in the next section, this one I've left primarily intact for you guys. So there's a lot of crunchy stuff here to read, but I think you all need to hear it. So this is diagnostic criteria. This is first section, a persistent pattern of inattention or hyperactivity impulsivity that interferes with functioning or development as characterized by number 1, which is attention, inattention, or number 2, hyperactivity and impulsivity. It's divided down in this list underneath each one. So inattention, 6 or more of the following symptoms, and it's going to be 5 for older adolescents and adults. 6 or more of the following symptoms have persisted for at least 6 months to a degree that's inconsistent with developmental level and that negatively impacts directly on social and academic or occupational activities. So, number A, often fails to give close attention to detail or makes careless mistakes in schoolwork, at work, or during other activities, overlooks or missed details, work isn't accurate, etc. B, often has difficulty sustaining attention in tasks or play activities, like has difficulty remaining focused during lectures, conversations, or lengthy reading. C, often does not seem to listen when spoken to directly. In other words, mind seems elsewhere even in the absence of any obvious distraction. D, often does not follow through on instructions and fails to finish schoolwork, chores, or duties in the workplace. In other words, starts tasks but quickly loses focus and is easily sidetracked. E, often has difficulty organizing tasks and activities. In other words, difficulty managing sequential tasks, difficulty keeping materials and belongings in order, messy, disorganized work, poor time management, fails to meet deadlines. F, often avoids, dislikes, or is reluctant to engage in tasks that require sustained mental effort. In other words, schoolwork or homework. For older adolescents and adults, preparing reports, completing forms, reviewing lengthy papers. G, often loses things necessary for tasks or activities. In other words, school materials, pencils, books, tools, wallets, keys, paperwork, eyeglasses, mobile phones. H, is often easily distracted by extraneous stimuli. For older adolescents and adults, may include unrelated thoughts. And I, is often forgetful in daily activities like doing chores, running errands. For older adolescents and adults, this could be returning calls, paying bills, keeping appointments. Okay. Dr. Mathis, do you have anything you want to add in here before I get to the next list? I want to make sure you have time to talk in between because these are long.
Yeah, we're good.
Okay. So the other half of the diagnosis is hyperactivity and impulsivity. So again, six or more persisting for 6 months, inconsistent with developmental level, and negatively impact social and academic activities. And for older adolescents and adults, only 5 symptoms are required for diagnosis. And these run up to H. So A, often fidgets with or taps hands or feet or squirms in your seat. B, often leaves seat in situations where remaining seated is expected. Leaves his or her place in the classroom, in the office, or other workplace, or in other situations that require remaining in place. Often runs around or climbs in situations where it is inappropriate. In that, adolescents or adults may be limited to feeling restless. C, often unable to play or engage in leisure activities quietly. D, is often on the go, acting as if driven by a motor. In other words, is unable to be or uncomfortable being still for extended time, as in restaurants, meetings, may be experienced by others as being restless or difficult to keep up with. E, often talks excessively. F, often blurts out an answer before a question has been completed. In other words, completing people's sentences, cannot wait for their turn in conversation. G, often has difficulty waiting his or her turn, for example, while waiting in line. And H, often interrupts or intrudes on others, like butts into conversations, butts into games or activities, may start using other people's things without asking or waiting to receive permission. For adolescents and adults, may intrude into or take over what others are doing. Other criteria, several inattentive or hyperactive impulsive symptoms present prior to age 12. Next, several inattentive or hyperactive impulsive symptoms present in 2 or more settings, like at home, at school, or work with friends or relatives in other activities. So 2 or more of these, it goes on. Next, there's clear evidence that the symptoms interfere with or reduce the quality of social, academic, or occupational functioning. And last, the symptoms do not occur exclusively during the course of schizophrenia or other psychotic disorder and are not better explained by another mental disorder, like a mood disorder, anxiety, dissociative personality disorder, or substance intoxication or withdrawal. Okay. Quick notes on the pathopsychology of ADHD. A lot of this was really crunchy, so I pulled just a couple out that I want you guys to understand. The important thing here is that there is biological stuff, chemistry in the body. Your body is behaving a certain way. This is not you being sassy and acting up and just not wanting to sit still and not listening. There's been a lot of damage done in our society by implying that this was just a choice to be a jackass. And so we're trying to explain the biology behind it so you guys can put that to bed. From A, the prefrontal and frontal lobes, and to some extent the cerebellum and temporal lobe, is thought to be the primary seat of etiological dysfunction with ADHD. And then C, I skipped B, ADHD persons commonly show early motor cortex development with delayed development in other areas, particularly the frontal and prefrontal cortex regions. Biochemistry of this, and Dr. Mathis is going to get all excited because we're talking about the deeds. So ADHD is predominantly what he refers to as a triple D disorder, a dopaminergic dysregulation disorder. I'm going to pause here and see if there's anything that you want to expand on with that.
Yeah, it doesn't mean Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives, my favorite TV show on the Food Channel.
Unfortunately, no.
Although I did steal the triple D from there.
Fair enough. That's all right.
Yeah. Well, it's just like I said before, if you have a lack of dopamine, you're going to have all kinds of problems. Logical thinking, following a linear path. That's why ADHD people tend to be tangential and talk all around and think all around the problem as opposed to going to the heart of the problem. But it's also why they're creative. The upside is that makes them more creative. The downside is they're trying to corral a tangential brain in a linear world, which doesn't really work well most of the time.
Yeah.
and if you don't have dopamine, you don't have a very well-formed prefrontal, which means you can't do abstract reasoning, also known as executive functioning. So that becomes the real kicker in the butter for those guys, because when you have that, you can't generalize from mistakes to other situations. You can't learn from your errors. It's much more difficult to do all that kind of stuff that those of us who don't have prefrontal cortex issues, we just kind of take for granted. Like, oh, can't everybody do that? Well, no.
Yeah. No, they actually can't. Yeah.
So you can teach folks with ADHD how to simulate like they're doing abstract reasoning, but you're really not. What you're teaching them is to chain a bunch of concrete thinking tasks together. And so it looks like they're doing abstract reasoning, but they're not. But that's also in terms of the psychomotor development, which is why they're usually good with athletics, because they have the motor cortex develops very early with them, unlike in my case, which I don't think it ever developed. And it's going to be me, Mr. Bill, which is why I love that, which is why these folks are typically good in performance arts, sculpture, painting, and they're good at athletic dancing. They're good at athletics, acting. They are physical hands-on and visual learners. They're not auditory abstract thinkers typically. There are a few that are, but in general, they're not. But that's part of the reason why they are, is because they have all this early motor cortex development. And if you look at schools in the early days, in elementary school and then kindergarten, kids don't have to use their prefrontals because they don't have them very much at that point. They haven't really developed. So the teacher's guiding everything. The teacher essentially becomes their prefrontal cortex. So the teacher is guiding everything. He or she is doing the structuring for them, is telling them what to do, how to do it, and they're participant body moving learners. And so you'll see these kids in elementary, and they'll get labeled gifted, and it's because they are. They have early motor cortex development, and they're even if you don't have somebody who is as impaired in that as I am, if you have a normal guy or gal who has motor cortex, these folks are typically heads and shoulders above those people. And that's why they get labeled as gifted in elementary school and get put in the tag classes, the advanced classes. But by the time middle school hits, when the prefrontals are starting to develop, theirs aren't. And now they can't keep up and the grades go down. And nobody can figure out what the heck's going on. And they think, oh, they're just being lazy. Oh, they're just not trying. Oh, it used to come easy to them, and now it doesn't come easy for them, so they've given up because they just don't want to do the work. No, if they've given up, it's because they can't get it because of the prefrontal issues, and nobody's recognizing that or getting the help they need, and that's a problem.
Got it. Okay, so related to all that, this is also seen with ADHD people. More dopamine transporters in the striatum, less neural blood flow and circulation, lower glucose metabolism, and decreased overall dopamine activity. Therefore, it doesn't inhibit negative or inappropriate behaviors because dopamine is part of that relationship as well. Also related to dopamine, in general, extroverts have higher levels of dopamine activity than introverts. And I have a question about that. I have been told repeatedly by several very ADHD people around me that they consider themselves introverts. So Is that because of this? Like, their dopamine is depleted because of the disorder, and that may have contributed to them becoming introverts because it's a biochemical thing?
And, excuse me, yeah, and because if they've gotten enough negative feedback on their hyperactivity, the easiest thing they can do to hide
withdraw.
It is, yep, ding, 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 we have a wiener.
Yep.
Yes, ma'am.
And, yeah, and we're going to talk about that in the next section, too, because I bet that plays into the rejection dysphoria thing.
Yes,
and
ma'am.
One of the huge traits that we kept hearing about, that the normal name for this kind of pretends is not there, or just, you know, ignores.
Well, they just don't know. I mean, the average person doesn't get it.
Yep. Okay. So other disorders that have a dopamine component to them, and we're not implying that people who have ADHD have any of these disorders, but it's interesting to see what other things have the same problems. And, you know, maybe this will lead to being able to help people when they can figure out the commonality. I don't know. But schizophrenia commonly shows higher dopamine levels in the mesolimbic pathway and decreased in the prefrontal. Number two, mania commonly shows overall more erratic and higher levels of dopamine. And Parkinson's, decreased dopamine secreting neurons in the substantia nigra due to age-related degeneration.
Yeah, and
okay.
It's different dopamines. And so it's different. Also, it's different different dopamine molecules. So, you know, people think of dopamine as, oh, there's one dopamine neurochemical and that's
okay.
It. Well, no,
yeah,
there's about 1,000 of these. Yeah, so there's about 1,000 of these little suckers. And we've identified a couple of hundred of them. And the dopamine that's responsible for schizophrenia and mania are different in large cases. They have some commonalities, but they have different dopamine molecules than the ones for ADHD. So that's because if you think about it, if it was the same dopamine neurochemical version, then there would be one medication that would fix everything, right? So every ADHD person would take Thorazine.
Got it.
You know?
Okay.
And every bipolar person would take Thorazine, because Thorazine, an antipsychotic, hits certain dopamine receptors. It doesn't hit all of them, right? The bipolar medication hits certain dopamine receptors in certain parts of the brain. It doesn't hit them in other parts of the brain. It doesn't hit every dopamine receptor on the planet any more than Adderall, Concerta, or Dexedrine, or Ritalin hit those involved in mania or Parkinson's or schizophrenia.
Got it. Okay. All right, so speaking of chemicals and self-medicating, so these are a list of foods and chemicals that are typically craved by people that have ADHD. So this goes all the way up from A to B. A, almost anything sweet, like various candies and things to get their sweet fat, mainly from simple carbohydrates.
Mm-hmm.
B, speaking of simple carbohydrates, sugar, especially the white kind.
Yep.
C, caffeinated drinks, coffee, blast energy drinks, any of that stuff. D, white pasta, again, you know, the simple carbohydrate version of things. E, alcohol. It's hypothesized due to the sugar content. And I think I raised that question later, and I realize now you've half answered it already in advance, but we'll come back to that.
Okay. Also, it dissociates them a bit. You know, it's a relaxant as well, so they're not as anxious and sensitive to the rejection.
Okay. Cool. And I may ask you to say it one more time when we get to the section where I had a note to ask you this later on.
Okay. One more time.
Yeah. not right now. Hallucinogenic products like, you know, pot, acid, peyote, that sort of thing. G, bad fats, especially hydrogenated fats.
Yeah, which nobody should hear.
Yeah. Actually, out of curiosity, what is the biochemical attraction to the bad fats? Like, what does that do?
Because they're immediate feel-good drugs. Yeah, the same.
Okay.
Sugar is also a feel-good drug. the reason that they do the bad fats is because the bad fats is what's mostly in junk food. And it's a quick fix, and they're cheap. So
okay.
if you go Yeah. So if you go for things like Doritos, Cheetos, whatever, and I'm not picking on those products, or any of those kind of products, and if they happen to be made with hydrogenated fat, they're getting a boatload of hydrogenated fat in their snack food, which also has, you know, a lot of those things have sugars and a lot of salt in them. So what happens with them is, unbeknownst to them, they're eating the fats that are clogging up their arteries and robbing their brains of nutrition and oxygen, which is making their prefrontals misfire even more. It makes everybody's misfire, but with an ADHD person, it's like misfiring on steroids.
Got it. Okay. Next one is H, fast foods, what we were just talking about, hypothesized due to the quick factor that is also combined with the bad fat and the simple sugar.
Uh-huh.
I, sugar-coated cereals. J, sugary soft drinks. K, high caloric foods, which have almost no nutritional value, combined with a high level of hydrogenated fats, sugar, and other simple carbs. L, junk
donuts,
foods,
for example.
Yeah. Not otherwise covered up here.
And the other reason they do that is because if you take a sugar and you eat a lot of sugar, it puts your body into hypoglycemic toxic shock. And when your body goes into toxic shock, it's literally in a life or death situation, just like you would stick your finger in an electric socket and pour water on yourself. And when your body's in fight or flight, guess what gets produced more? Dopamine. So we're back to that again.
Interesting. That's going to play into something I have going on later on.
This is why I like being a nerd.
That's perfectly fine. And, you know, and I know you guys tell us, we talk about crunchy stuff, but it's important for y'all to know this. And if you save it as a podcast, you can listen to it over and over again until you kind of get down all the stuff that we said, because I know we're using a lot of terminology and information here and, condensing a lot of data.
Right. Yeah. And that's why I'm trying to normalize that people go, okay, sugar, toxic shock. Okay. That bad. And it's generating dopamine. So I'm getting two for one. I'm getting awakened by the toxic shock and the dopamine's producing more dopamine. So my brain feels more active. I feel more alive because dopamine is also responsible for feeling good and pleasure sensation. That's why I also call it the James Brown chemical. You know, I feel good.
Got it.
Like I knew I would.
Okay, so the rest of the list, we got nicotine, sugared juices, full fat items, and pre-sweetened iced tea.
Especially if you're in the South.
Oh, God, yeah.
Double pre-sweetened while it's still warm so the sugar super saturates in it. Oh, my God.
True. Okay, so the next part is a section on essentially what amounts to comorbidity discussion. So these are common co-occurring disorders, vary to some degree based on the age of the individual. So these are some things that frequently come up when you have ADHD. Substantial evidence suggests that ADHD, LD, which would be learning disorder, CD, which I believe is conduct disorder, and ODD, oppositional defiance disorder, significantly coexist with children. Anxiety and depressive disorders are not uncommon as well.
Right, because ADHD people aren't dumb. They know they're not getting it. They know they're getting rejected by their peers. They know that, and which is why they're increased sensitivity. And let's face it, if you know stuff and you think you're as smart as the next person, but you can't get it out, you can't get your brain to do it, pretty soon you're going to be pretty depressed about it, and then you're going to be pretty stressed out. And then we want to look for, you know, better living through chemistry solutions, which, you know, is why you see a lot of these folks are comorbid with substance abuse disorders.
Yep, they're self-medicating.
That is exactly correct.
And then with adolescents, the evidence suggests that ADHD, LD, CD, ODD, and substance-related disorders co-occur at high rates.
If you're an ADHD male, particularly if you have more of the hyperactivity component, you have a 63% chance of having either oppositional defiant or conduct disorder. And yeah. if you're an ADHD male with ODD or CD, you have a 90%+ chance of having multiple substance-related disorders.
Yikes.
Yeah. 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 Welcome to my caseload.
oh, indeed.
Right, and if you're and if you're a substance abusing ADHD adolescent, you probably turn into a substance using ADHD adult.
Yeah.
Right. So probably at any one time in my caseload, about 75% to 85% of my caseload, adult and kid, are ADHD with co-occurring LDs, CDs, whatever, ODDs, whatever. But all of them just about have a substance problem. I almost never run into an ADHD person who doesn't have a substance problem. Especially if they're male.
Interesting.
Yeah. It's very common.
Yeah.
And, of course, if you're doing substances, you're also screwing up your brain more. So now you have greater deficits, which means you're having greater losses and disappointments at work, at school, which means you're getting rejected more, which, and you can see where this is going.
Yeah. Vicious cycle.
Uh-huh.
So, all right, let me go ahead with the rest of the section. So
sure.
anxiety and depressive disorders are also common. And remember, we're talking about adolescents. In some cases, APD, personality disorder, especially cluster B ones, may begin to develop or already be in full swing. Should that occur, suicidal gestures rather than genuine attempts are sometimes seen. Now, adults with ADHD have a high comorbidity rate with substance-related disorders, learning disability, anxiety disorders, depressive disorders, PTSD, and various personality disorders, especially those within cluster B. Those with
as compensation. Think of the ADHD, if it's severe enough and they get it early enough and they have enough rejection and negative whatevers, think of all of those experiences combined being a form of trauma-esque related stuff. And if you have enough of that stuff and you don't have a high resiliency, that's the kind of folks that develop cluster B personality. You have a greater chance to develop cluster B personality disorders, particularly borderlines or narcissists.
Huh.
Yeah.
Oh, I shouldn't do crunchy thinking while I'm in the middle of a show.
I'm having a moment. yeah. I mean,
I'm beginning to have regrets about saying I don't want this to be a three-parter because now I'm thinking about something. Well, I'll bring it up later.
okay. Well, you know, to quote the line from the old joke, if the foo shits, wear it, right?
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Also, those with personality disorders will often exhibit various eating disorders and or self-harm behaviors, not of a genuinely suicidal nature, but more of a suicidal gesture nature for secondary gains, such as getting undue attention, punishing those around who are not gratifying their desires, engendering guilt in others, or as escape avoidant manipulation.
Which is why it was also theorized that Marilyn Monroe was a borderline, and because she had had several suicide gestures prior to her actual accomplishing it. And one of the big theories out there is because she had the phone off the hook right near her, that she was too stoned to call for help, that she waited too long to call for help. And that's why she ended up dying.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay. So here's a list of ADHD risk factors from the Mayo Clinic. First, having a parent with ADHD, being male, having been exposed to environmental toxins as a child, mothers who smoked, drank, or used other drugs of abuse during pregnancy, mothers who were exposed to environmental toxins during pregnancy, and being premature. ADHD can manifest differently in adults than in children and adolescents, although some of the characteristics are similar, such that adults commonly report more issues with, and, you know, this is a list of symptoms. And I know that listeners are going to be adults, so you guys need this list especially. Chronic boredom, usually accompanied by sensation-seeking activities. Repeated lateness and forgetfulness. depression, difficulty concentrating when reading, problems controlling anger, employment issues with frequent changes in jobs, usually due to being fired for poor performance, disciplinary actions filed against them, and or being employed way below what one might expect them to be capable of doing. Anxiety, impulsivity, poor frustration tolerance, coupled with a tendency to give up easily, lowered self-esteem, moodiness, impaired organization skills, procrastination, frequent homework and or academic problems, substance abuse or dependency, troubled interpersonal relations, work resulting in being demoted or written up, repeated losing and changing jobs, being underemployed, and academic underachievement and or failure resulting in having to repeat classes or grades at school, being expelled or dropping out. And this is another list of commonly co-occurring problems with ADHD persons. Given that 80% of all ADHD persons have at least one co-occurring condition, often many have more than just one. And we did talk about some of this earlier, but this is a more complete list. Oppositional defiant disorder, conduct disorder, depression, anxiety disorders, bipolar disorder, learning disability and or developmental disorders, about 30%, especially abstract reasoning or executive function problems. Tourette's, 50% of Tourette's kids have ADHD, but not the reverse, interestingly. Enuresis or bedwetting, somewhat uncommon. Auditory processing disorders, extremely common. Substance-related disorders, common in later progressing ADHD.
Yeah, and the bipolar thing is like Tourette's. A lot, some of the bipolar people will have ADHD, but ADHD doesn't necessarily result in bipolar disorder.
Got it. I find that interesting that it's all one-sided. And there's got to be a useful something with that. I can't put my finger on it, but it seems like that should point to something of use with it, you know, dealing with it and possibly even helping it. Okay, so my last note, I wanted to make a point to mention this book while we're talking about diagnosing things. So in February 2014, Chicago neurologist and ADHD specialist Dr. Richard Saul published a provocatively titled book, ADHD Does Not Exist, in which he proposes that ADHD is not an entity in itself, but a cluster of symptoms that stem from more than 20 other conditions, including depression, anxiety, bipolar, and obsessive-compulsive disorder. Many of those, along with dysfunctional behavior conditions such as oppositional defiant disorder, characterized by aggression, tantrums, and a propensity to argue with adults, and learning disabilities such as dyslexia, are often diagnosed as co-illnesses with ADHD. Saul criticizes the catch-all nature of an ADHD diagnosis, which he believes corrals a lot of real conditions into one. And covering this is from the article Growing Up with ADHD by Denise Foley in Time Magazine online. It was undated, but likely released in 2014 or 15, not long after the book came out. Now, we do not necessarily stand by Dr. Saul's assertion, but are simply sharing it here for discussion purposes, as many listeners have mentioned his book to me in preparation for doing this show. And I'm going to stop here and check in with you, Dr. Mathis, see how we're doing. We're actually at the top of the hour, so it might be a good place to pause, but we can discuss that.
Yeah, well, needless to say, I think that Dr. Saul has really, I think, missed the boat on this one. I think what he's talking about is co-occurring conditions, because my theory is that if you didn't have ADHD, a lot of these other conditions wouldn't exist, minus the bipolar and the Tourette's and that kind of stuff. And I see very, very few people with ADHD who also have obsessive traits. They have, a lot of them have what's called perseverative traits, which people sometimes mistake for obsessive compulsive traits. And the difference, and I can make the difference really easy for folks. So if you're a good obsessive like me, oops, did I say that? What you do
outlaw voice.
Is, yeah, really. My unmedicated voice again. What you do if you have compulsive perfectionistic obsessive type tendencies is your perfectionism and obsessions tend to revolve around one or two things. So for me, it's like music, 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 or cooking, 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 cooking. It's not music 1 minute, cooking 1 minute, politics the next minute, auto mechanics the next minute. Oh, that would be the last thing I'd be doing. But with ADHD, given my dearth of skills in this arena, with ADHD people, it's almost like a time-limited compulsion. So it's like baseball, 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 baseball for 2 or 3 weeks, then tennis, 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 then girls, 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 boys, 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 girls, music, 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 clothes, 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 clothes. And they flip-flop. They go from one thing to the next thing to the next thing to the next thing. They don't stick. They're being very poor obsessive. They're jumping around too much. So think of perseveration as a time-limited version of an obsessive compulsive type trait. And so a lot of parents will say, well, my kid can sit there and play video games for 20 hours and never roar. They don't have a focusing problem. Hello, video games are generating, and they're probably first-person shooters or racing games or explosion games, because what is that doing? That's right, it's generating dopamine. Hello, McFly, right? And if they're flipping from one thing to the next thing to the next thing, haven't you noticed they don't stick with anything? Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. That's called perseveration, honey, and that is part of the ADHD thing, and it has nothing to do with compulsion, because a true compulsive would never jump from one thing to the next thing. Take it from a guy who knows. I've been a nerd with the music and the cooking since I started, and that has never changed, ever. So that's the difference in perseveration and obsessiveness. And that's why ADHD people often get mislabeled. Because I've had people come in, adults come in and go, yeah, I've got ADHD and OCD. And I have seen it for real in a couple of cases, but it's pretty rare. And what they're mistaking for OCD is perseveration. And who's ever doing the interviewing and the labeling is not doing a very good job, which unfortunately is very common in my business.
Yeah. Actually, that reminds me of something that I did read, and I don't have it in my notes here, but I think it's kind of important given what you just said. It was commentary that had to do with Dr. Saul's book that was actually useful. And, you know, part of his contention about why he says it doesn't exist, it's overdiagnosed, is because typically people that diagnose it are not in a position like you are. They're typically just random pediatricians. You get 7 minutes with the kid. And they don't get time to do a mumpy. They don't get time to do proper observation and testing. And they're pressured
to diagnose something.
Exactly. And they don't have
there's somebody in my field who's capable of doing it, but they're, for whatever reason, and I'm going to give a myriad of reasons because I don't want to read in anybody's, you know, give motive in anybody's rationale, but they're either too lazy to do it, let's just be honest, or they're too tied in with the managed care companies, which forbid you to do it, basically, even though they say, we don't really forbid you to do it, we're just not going to pay you for it. So if you choose to do it, go ahead. And you can't bill the patient for it either. Yeah. or they just really hate it, and they don't have anybody in their office to do it, and they're not knowledgeable enough or too lazy or whatever to refer to somebody who does. They don't know who does. They're not in the know or whatever. And so they do it on intake interview in anywhere from a 15 to a 45 minute, usually a 30 to 45 minute interview, because some of the managed care companies say, okay, for your intake interview, you have maximum 45 minutes. Go.
Yeah.
And there is no way in heaven, hell, earth, purgatory, or the twilight zone that if you've got somebody who's a really complicated, convoluted case like most of the ones I get, you're going to barely scratch the surface in 30 minutes. I mean, I'm really good at what I do, and I say that very unnarcissistically, but I'm not God, and I can't lay hands on and diagnose somebody in 20 minutes. Ain't no way.
Yeah.
Not doing it. And I'm not going to misdiagnose somebody, because misdiagnosis leads to mistreatment, literally. And, you know, this is people's lives you're talking about. You don't go fiddle farting around with that. If you have a brain and a moral, you just don't do it. And that's part of the reason I never engaged in these managed care games because it's like, no, I'm sorry, I'm not going to give a half-baked diagnosis and screw somebody's life up potentially. I could guess right, but I'm not willing to take that risk.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's important stuff.
I don't blame you. Yeah.
I mean, that's important stuff. It's not like you go back and repaint the walls. Oh, I don't like that shade of blue. Okay, let me just come back tomorrow and repaint them. You misdiagnose somebody. Diagnosis is what drives treatment.
Yeah.
So if you do a proper assessment, which is what drives diagnosis, you do a 30 or 45 minute or even 1 hour, and you suspect somebody's got ADHD, and you don't do testing, you don't know what learning disorders they have, you don't know how bad they are, you don't know what gifts they have, because a lot of ADHD people I test, they also have gifts in areas. And the testing shows that too. And that's what I help to use to help corral in the other stuff that isn't so hot. Well, if you don't do the testing, how the hell are you going to know that? No two ADHD people are the same any more than two people are the same, right? And if you treat people like diagnosis, you're missing the boat.
Yeah. Exactly.
You know,
so
that's important to know.
I think what we'll probably do is, as much as I tried not to do this, we may end up having our first three-parter show because I have not yet been able to get to the actual meat and potatoes that created this episode. And I apologize to you guys that I'm saying so much before getting down to it, but essentially I'm going to skip down to something and I'm going to read this to you guys because we've never gotten to it. There was a meme that went around and this is what started all of this. And I want you guys to hear it because I want you to understand why I've been giving you the crunchy data and everything to understand the history of what all's gone on with this particular pathology. It's something that has affected so many people. As Dr. Saul's been fussing, it's been overdiagnosed. And that part is true. I think his book is bullshit. Sorry, Doc. but some of the complaints and the premise of some of his complaints, I think, is perfectly valid. So there's this meme that went around on the internet, and it was basically a piece from Twitter, somebody's tweet, and it went around on, I think, Instagram, and somebody made commentary underneath it. So here's how it goes. The first tweet says, quote, ADHD is the most poorly named affliction ever. Like, hi, do you have a profound physical inability to accomplish your goals specifically because they're your goals? And also, the thought of your friends not liking you makes you want to die. You may have trouble sitting still disorder. And then under the tweet is this comment. It's made as a fake hashtag. And, you know, the format's wrong, but they are making commentary by this. And it says, hashtag, it's so obvious they named it based on how we inconvenience them rather than what it actually does to us. And then the comment to that is, there the fuck it is. And this meme, and how much it upset a lot of people online who have this particular diagnosis, is how we got here. So I wanted you guys to hear that part so that you can understand unpacking all of this. I'm not defending what they're doing. I'm actually standing up for it. But why I've been so pedantic, why I've been so detailed, giving the history and all of this, is so we can see how the hell we got here in hopes of examining whether we need to go in another direction. Because we said last time, we said this time, and in the remaining notes I haven't given you yet, there are definitely quite a few places in which there is room to grow with how the professional community treats this diagnosis. And there are definitely at least two or three areas that always get short shrift and never get treated like the hyperactivity or anything else does. Go ahead.
I was going to say it is both an overdiagnosed condition and an underdiagnosed condition, because I also get people who get misdiagnosed as bipolar or misdiagnosed as whatever, or they have depression or they have anxiety. And okay, well, maybe they do, but did you ask, you know, did you look beyond the curtain to see why they have depression and anxiety? And you talk to them, and if you've done as much ADHD work as I've done, it's like ding, it's like they got a neon sign on their forehead going, I might have ADHD, ding, 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 ding. And I'm just thinking to myself, what idiot or set of idiots has dealt with this person who hasn't seen this behavior? I'm seeing it. What the hell? Why aren't you asking the questions? Why aren't you suggesting the testing? Why aren't you at least giving them a take-home questionnaire to fill out to, as kind of a starting place to jump off? Because it causes so much havoc in people's lives because it goes undiagnosed. And, of course, the longer it goes undiagnosed, it's not like wine. It doesn't get better with age. You know, it's kind of like, you know, viruses. It gets worse the longer you let them breathe. So you get people in their 30s. You know, if you have an ADHD person who is not being treated successfully with the ADHD by age 10 or 11, their brain miswires exponentially every year thereafter.
Yeah.
So by the time they're 30 or 40 and they're coming in for depression or drug addiction or whatever, they may well have those, but what is the etiology of those? What started the ball rolling? Oh,
yeah.
Maybe it was the ADHD and feeling like dog shit about the ADHD and trying to, you know, make themselves feel better or compensate or whatever.
Yeah.
Okay, well, you know, you solve the core problem. You solve a lot of the other stuff too. It goes away, but you've got to, you know, you got to do the testing. You got to know what you're looking at. You've got to at least explore it.
You got to do the work.
Exactly. There's no way around it. People in my business and related fields have got to get off their assets and do their job. There's no two ass ways about it. And if you don't do that, we're going to continue to be seeing it as a hyperactive type disorder, and you know, it's you're giving it short shrift.
Yeah.
The hyperactivity might be what annoys other people about it, you know, and I can certainly speak to that. But you know, I don't. If all it was annoying hyperactive behavior, I'd tell people to like me to suck it up and just get over it and look the other way. It's a whole lot. It's a whole lot more than just that. I mean, it is a serious neurological wiring problem. That is really not their responsibility. It's not their fault, quote unquote. But it is their responsibility to do something about it. But it's our responsibility as professionals to be looking at this stuff and suggesting to these people, hey, have you ever thought about this? And hey, this is what I'm seeing. Has nobody ever suggested that you might have this?
Yeah. I mean, how many kids have you had come into your office and obviously had this, but they told them there was something else? They were, you know, bipolar or allergic to sugar or something, you know, just some other bullshit. That had nothing to do with it.
Or just being a bad kid. You're being a difficult conduct.
Yeah.
You're bad, you're nationwide.
Right?
To quote ZZ Top. I'm on a ZZ Top roll tonight, can I tell you? They're having their 50th anniversary this year, so I'm real proud of them.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, I'm really proud of them. It's hugely frustrating as a clinician who is as compulsive as I am and who gives a flip as much as I do with people I work with. It's just disheartening because for every one or two people that I see who I can finally get the right diagnosis and help for, there's 1,000 others who I never hear about. And some of these people have been put on medication for years. This one person, an adult, came into my office, had been on bipolar meds for 3 years. And the only reason the physician sent them to me for testing is because none of the bipolar meds worked and the person was getting worse and about to lose their family and their job and yada, yada, yada. And it became obvious to me in the first 35, 40 minutes, this person might have ADHD. And I'm like, oh, my Lord. And, you know... And of course, now this person's been on all these bipolar meds for 2.5 years, which make the ADHD, which really screw your brain up. Those are serious medications. You don't just go, oh, well, try Abilify. Oh, try Ticagrelor. Lithium carbonate. You'll like it. I mean, holy manoli. So now this person has 2.5 years of his or her brain being pissed up by the medication, by the physician who had great intentions, but... You know, they should have sent him a lot sooner than that. But that's how physicians are trained in med school. You try this stuff for 2 years. If it doesn't work, you send them someone like me to find out what the real problem is. Great idea. Not. Which is why I dropped out and didn't go to med school. So, because I found out psychiatrists were trained, and I went, oh, hell no. That's not going to be me. No. And I'm not slamming psychiatrists because I have a couple of folks that I know that are psychiatrists that are really, really good at what they do despite their med school training. Yeah. Well, you know, I joke about, you know, some of the training I got. I'm just like kind of looking sideways going, really, guys? Anyway, it is imperative that clinicians step up their game. So whatever variety they are, so that they are not missing these people. And if that means going outside of managed care and telling managed care to take a hike and where to stick the DSM, then that's what you need to do, because you're not doing your folks a service at all.
Yeah. So I think, we'll go ahead and since we're at the end of a main section, I'm going to go ahead and pause here, and we will make a section
you can blame
three.
This one.
So, you know, when I mentioned, we have another show coming up on September 18th, and now we know what our topic will be, is that we will get to these other parts of the pathology that are not discussed and, you know, get into those in detail. Is there anything else that you want to talk about real quick before we close up on this tonight?
No, I probably said too much already.
All right. On behalf of myself, Dr. Mathis, and NDB Media, we want to thank our listeners this evening. Give our appreciation to those of you who may be joining us later via podcast, iTunes, etc. We'll see you guys in 2 weeks with a new topic, which will be part three of this on Wednesday, September 18th, 11 p.m. EDT, right here on blogtalkradio.com. We also want to give a shout out to other NDB Media shows coming up in the next couple of weeks. Tomorrow, Thursday the 5th at 8 p.m. is Travel Itch Radio. What happens when an international aid worker decides to write about her experiences? One result is The Enlightenment of Bees, an uplifting novel by Rachel London, who's the guest on Travel Itch Radio. Listen live on Blog Talk Radio at 8 p.m. when Roger Noriega, pinch-hitting for Dan Schlossberg, and Anita Stokes-Thomas interview Rachel live, asking her about her various visits to more than 50 countries, in addition to her book, which went on sale July 9th. On Sunday, the 8th, at 8:30 p.m., I'll be hosting Fear Walking Dead Online Viewing Party, Episode 13, Leave What You Don't. Monday the 9th at 10 p.m., Monday Night in America with host Roger Noriega. And the following Sunday, the 15th at 8:30, I'm hosting Fear the Walking Dead Online Viewing Party, Episode 14, today and tomorrow. So please look for us on Facebook, on Twitter, on iTunes, and at www.rockandrollshrink.com. Good night, everybody, and giggle, and rock on.